world. Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love, number 184. I'm creator and host, Don Hutchison. Every day, I interview someone from around the world who has discovered his talents to do work he loves to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Todd Schnick. Welcome, Todd.
Don, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. Todd, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Yeah, you know, I am. And it took me a long time to get there, and I will be the first to admit I don't know that I necessarily followed a very meticulous, well-thought-out, and thought-through plan. I just stumbled upon that. And I don't apologize for that, because I got where I needed to be, I think. So I'm very fortunate that I am doing that, but it was anything but a straight path to get there.
I hear you, and that's why we're here today. We want to hear the whole story, all the gory details. Now co-founder of the Intrepid Now Media Network, Todd Schnick is a media and business strategist and talk show host and producer. He's a former marketing strategist, national political operative, and lobbyist. Todd has published 5 books, writes a business and lifestyle column, is a distance runner, and lives in Brookhaven, Georgia with his wife, Stephanie, and family. So Todd, that's a pithy summation of your career. Tell us what you're up to now that has you fired up.
Yeah, well, you know, to answer your first question of am I doing work where I use my talent and doing stuff that I love, yeah, it's building this media company. And that's what drives me. That's what inspires me. That's what motivates me. That's why when I get up in the morning, I'm enthusiastic, where I wasn't that for most of my life. And so, yeah, I'm just focusing on building this media company, which is a platform that we've built to entertain and educate an audience. And then we use that as a vehicle to shine a light on amazing people building and doing amazing things. So I like to say a much simpler biography for me is just interview cool people doing cool things. And that's how I spend my life. It's a great way it's a great existence.
Oh, wow. And how new is the media company?
Oh, Intrepid Now itself is only about 1 year old, but I've been doing work of this nature for probably 5-ish years now. So, yeah, no, this media company is relatively new, and I learned some lessons from the last 5 years that I wanted to apply to a new business, and that in and of itself has been gratifying to make some mistakes and learn some things and do it better. So to answer your question, the company's about a year old.
Okay, excellent. Wish you all great success with that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So as you know, as we've discussed, life is about turning points. Every 6 or 8 years we face obstacles and issues and have choices and changes that we have to deal with that determine the next 4 or 5 years of our lives. Take us back in your storyline, in your backstory, if you will, to some of the more interesting turning points in the life of Todd Schnick.
I'd have to say that the biggest turning point in my life started, I've had several, but the first major one was in college when I went there and I fell into the trap that so many people fall into, that they just start living a life that society, that culture, that friends, that family expect them to live, right? And so I, like most guys, I went into college thinking, oh, I guess I'll get a business degree, and went down that path. And then somehow I turned a corner there. And I don't give that due credit to how my life turned out, because it was actually the first courageous move I ever made in my life was changing my educational path. And I ended up getting 2 degrees, one in history and one in political science. I'd always been fascinated certainly by American history. And so for whatever reason, I had decided to change the business path, which was weird and strange because I was in a fraternity and 98% of my fraternity were business guys, right? Were business majors. And I was the one guy that was doing something a little bit different. I went to a different building for classes, unlike everyone I hung out with in school. And so I got into history and then I started getting into politics. And I went to Florida State, mm-hmm. which, as you know, is the capital of the state of Florida. And so naturally, a lot of exciting, interesting political opportunities there. And I stumbled in and started work for the United States Senator and then did some work for the Republican Party of Florida. And that's how I kind of got into this thing. And through that, made some relationships that ultimately proved fruitful in my political career. But the day before I graduated, I was going to graduate on a Saturday. And on Sunday, I was going to load up the car and I was going to drive up to Boston and I was going to get a master's in history. My plan was to be a teacher, a professor of history. And Friday before graduation, I get a phone call from a U.S. congressman who offered me a job. And I immediately diverted my plan. And that's how my political career started. But that was the big first change for me, Don, was a turning point for me, was having the courage I didn't recognize it was a courageous move until just really started thinking about that recently. But that was my first turning point. But then I got into the political career, which was a very exciting.
Well, let me interrupt you here. Listen, you did the business thing. You got in the business thing with everybody else, but that wasn't in your sweet spot. So you got over into history, which is hardly business, but totally fascinating. And poli-sci, okay. You did all that. You did some work with a U.S. senator. That, for a college student to be working with a U.S. senator, that doesn't happen to everybody. I mean, you had to have sought that out and talked your way into that position. I mean, how did that happen? And then you get a call from a congressman. I mean, those are very important steps there that showed a lot of stuff, a lot of grit, a lot of talent, a lot of insight.
I appreciate you asking the question in that way, Don, but it wasn't exactly a Jedi move here. I mean, it was made application and had a nice conversation with the team. I wasn't the chief of staff to the U.S. senator.
I hear you.
I was doing some staff work in one of many state district offices, you know, and just doing constituent service. So the highlight of that experience there was I was working for Senator Connie Mack, a Republican out of Florida. And I was there during the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. So if you remember that was quite an experience. Explosive time to be working for a senator's office. So it kind of lit the fuse on how exciting and interesting a career in that space could be. But that job was largely focused on constituent service, which is let's be honest, that's the main purpose of our representatives in Congress is to serve constituents. And that was the work I did. And very exciting stuff and very rewarding and very important. But the work at the Republican Party of Florida is where I got the bug. It was less policy, less constituent service, and more the politics and the strategy side of it and the messaging and the media. But that first job with the member of Congress was still largely constituent service and was a district aide to the congressman and spent time with him traveling around and learning. So that was a very exciting career and one of those things that when you passed out your business card to people as a young 20-something, it was impressive to have this gold embossed seal of the United States House of Representatives on your card. So it was kind of cool. You know, it was a lot of fun and meaningful. It wasn't a lucrative career, but public service often isn't, right? I mean, it was rewarding in a lot of other ways.
Okay. So how long did you say that you stayed with a congressman working in that role?
I was just with the congressman for about 3 years and ultimately ran his district office out of Jacksonville. But then I decided with my wife to move back to Tallahassee and get a master's. And the funny thing was, I did dive into that master's degree for a couple of years, but I came back to work for the Republican Party of Florida. So that's how I got back into politics. And I ended up working at the Republican Party of Florida for, gosh, I think 5, maybe 6 years. That culminated in my work as the political director for the operation during the 2000 presidential campaign. And we all know what happened in Florida in 2000 with Bush versus Gore. Right. And so I was knee deep in that whole recount scenario and testified in many, many cases, was sued. Proud to say that I was sued by Al Gore. And if you dive deep enough into my Google searches, you will find transcripts of all my testimony and all of that. So it was a surreal experience to be part of the Florida recount in 2000. It was one of those deals where, because I was on TV, I got death threats. We had U.S. Marshals patrolling our building because there were assassination threats on not only all of us, but all the VIPs that were spending time, people like Jim Baker, right, former Secretary of State, and was kind of leading that effort. And so he had all kinds of death threats. And any vehicle within a mile radius of our operations that had a Bush-Cheney sticker on it got their windows smashed. It was a surreal experience. I look back on it now, and it was a fascinating thing to be a part of and to experience and to see firsthand and to be behind the scenes and dive into that whole thing and be part of the legal strategy, which there were at any given moment 250 legal proceedings going on all related to that. So the army of lawyers trying to figure all these things out and whilst doing this in front of an international stage of people wondering what the heck's going to happen with the outcome of this presidential race. It was a fascinating thing. So it was an exciting part of my political career, no doubt about it.
Good heavens. Do you think that in the final analysis, there were so many details, it's almost like it'd be impossible to come out with a perfect outcome? Do you think the right outcome was reached?
Well, I certainly think so. My guy was ultimately successful in that endeavor. You know, I look back on that whole experience and I joke with people, the very first book that I was ever mentioned in was a book by Jake Tapper, who now is a very prominent journalist, I think at CNN. But at the time, he was just a beat reporter for, I want to say ABC News, but I don't remember. Anyway, he wrote a book called Down and Dirty, The Plot to Steal the Presidency. So I'm very proud that was the first book. I'm saying that with a wink in my eye. That was the first book that I was in. But yeah, no, a very exciting time to be a part of politics.
So what happened next?
Well, after the Florida experience, I had opportunities to go to Washington with the Bush administration, but I had no interest in going to Washington. So I wanted to do something very different than Florida. Now, Florida in 2000 was an exciting time to be a Republican. Obviously, at the time, Jeb Bush was the governor, and he was a wonderful guy to work with and just a wonderful man. And I learned a lot from him, and it was an exciting time. And raising cash to do what we had to do was I had tens of millions of dollars to spend in my budget. It was an exciting time to be a part of that. So I wanted something different than that. I wanted a completely different, a completely unique challenge. And I'll be perfectly frank, I'd been in Florida politics many years. I needed something different. So I ended up going out west, and I ended up running the Nevada Republican Party. Now, our budget was probably $100,000 when I had been working with a budget of $100 million in Florida. And I had a staff of, I think, two people in Nevada, where we had a staff of almost 100 in Florida. So it was a very different environment. And Nevada is obviously an intriguing place and is an exciting place and a lot of interesting things happening there. And so I was in Florida for, Nevada for probably about, 10, 11 months before I was recruited back to the Southeast, and the Bush White House had me come back and run the Georgia Republican Party, which is how I ended up back here. And so I was running the Georgia operation in the 2002 campaign, and that ended up being a very successful cycle for us. We elected the first ever Republican governor in Georgia, defeated an incumbent Democratic senator, Max Cleland, and took over the Georgia State Senate for the first time ever. And so it was a very exciting time. As you recall, the timeline here, 2002 was the election after 9/11. So it was an interesting, tense, unique time in American history to be deep involved with the White House and to be kind of on the front lines as they were working through keeping our nation safe and launching a war effort and still running the country. And being a part of that was, got to know people like Karl Rove, which was interesting to have those guys as part of my life. And because they were obviously big players in American history.
Yeah, to say the very, very least. What'd you do next?
Well, that's when I went into lobbying. So after we had a very successful Georgia election, I did what most young, ambitious fellows did and tried to cash in and take advantage of the new Republican government in Georgia and lobbied for, it wasn't even a full year. I just did not enjoy that work. It was not rewarding. I wasn't good at it because I just wasn't into it. So I lobbied for not even a year. And it was one of those things. I describe it like you walk by a window and you see an outfit and you say, I really like the way that outfit looks, but you buy it without trying it on. And you finally put it on and it doesn't really fit, but you say, if I just wear it a bit, it'll ultimately fit me. Well, it never did. So
why not? Why not?
I don't want to get into the details there. I just, a lobbying career, which requires a set of skills and a set of principles that just wasn't me, and the required actions that just was not something that I really wanted to do. And people listening understand what a role of a lobbyist is. You try to influence and educate a governmental body to take an action that's favorable to a cause that you're in support of. And sometimes always do things you want to do to get someone to support your cause. And it just wasn't my kind of a thing. So what I did, obviously, no surprise to anyone listening to my story so far, as I went into political consulting. And so started a company with a friend of mutual colleague of mine from my Florida days. And we started a political consultancy. And we did that for about 3 years, achieved a lot of success. Frankly, that's been my most lucrative business tenure in my career in terms of the money I made was as a political consultant in those 3 years. By that time, Don, I was burning out on politics. I just wasn't my thing anymore. I feel like I had done my duty. I had served what I felt was my country well and my party well and put in a good amount of time and affected a lot of change and achieved a lot of amazing things. I'm very proud of the track record that me and my colleagues over all those years had. I mean, we achieved a lot of things. It turned Florida government Republican, elected Jeb Bush governor, elected George W. Bush president, changed Georgia from Democrat to Republican state. I'm very, very proud of that record in my political career. But I was just ready for something different. Now, what I did was I became a marketing strategist. And people say, well, you didn't do anything and you didn't get a marketing degree. And I said, what do you think I was doing as a political operative? I was in marketing. I wasn't selling soap. I wasn't selling consumer electronics. I was selling candidates. I was selling ideas. I was marketing. Sending out direct mail for a political campaign is no different than sending out direct mail for advertising a local restaurant. It was all marketing, you know? So, and the funny thing was, as I was doing that political consulting, I was working for some candidates running for local offices, these weren't full-time politicians. These were people that were earning a living. They had small businesses and they happened to be running for office. And so doing some of that work on their local campaigns, they began to say, oh, why don't you help me out a little bit with the marketing for my business? And I just ended up getting much more interested in that. And at this stage, it was late 2000s. And so social media was beginning to peek its head above the horizon a bit as the new frontier in marketing and communications. And it just struck me as something very, very interesting and a new sandbox I wanted to play in. So I ultimately separated from my first business partner very amicably. We had wanted to go in different directions. And then I started my own company, which exists to this day, which is the Intrepid Group. So that was how I got into becoming a marketing strategist.
Excellent. Okay, that's a good break point here. What do you think it is? Why is it in the world that, according to a couple of decades worth of research by Gallup and Pew and others, that most people are not in their sweet spots, that they underutilize their talents? They might be making a good living, but they're just not following their passion, their values, their interests, their talents as much as they might. What's that all about, and why is that?
I think it's as simple as this, Don, is that they start living someone else's life. They start living a life that they believe society, that the culture, that their friends, perhaps their family, expect them to live, right? It was like I said, when I was in college, everyone I knew was going to get that business degree, and I started doing it the same way, even though it wasn't something that I was really interested. And the funny thing is I've become a very successful entrepreneur and businessman later in my career. But the fact is, at the time, it wasn't my interest. I think the answer to your question, I think most people are doing things that they think they're supposed to be doing. Maybe they have family obligations. Maybe they have children they have to support. Maybe they have aged parents that they need to support. Maybe they have to do something. But their focus is not on being happy. Their focus is not on doing something meaningful and important and inspiring to them. Their focus is making money to achieve and check off a list of things that they think they're supposed to be doing. And somehow you get into that trap. And then life happens, right? You obtain debt, you obtain responsibilities, you just get into this groove, and it's hard. It's really hard. Society does not make it easy to break out of that groove. And I'm very fortunate. Now, you just heard me a minute ago walk through what seemed like an interesting career, but I hit a wall. I got into a point where I wasn't fulfilled anymore by what I was doing. And to the extent, I mean, I was fortunate that I was ultimately worked my way out of a political career that was no longer satisfying to me and fulfilling. But let me tell you, to this day, people still ask me about my political career. That's the thing about my life and the career that interests most people, because that's not surprising. Oh, you worked for George W. Bush? Wow. I want to talk about that. You were in part of the Florida recount. I want to talk about that. Well, that was 15 years ago now. That's part of my life, but it's long ago. And so I'm rambling here, but to get back to your question, I think people fall into a trap and they live a life that they expect someone else to, that they think they're supposed to be living. And I think the reason that such a high percentage of people responding to those surveys answer that they're unhappy is because they're not really doing what they want to do. And they don't have any idea how to get out of it, or they don't have the courage to do it.
So how do they do it? What would you say?
Well, it's a great question. And boy, if it was a simple three-step process to do it, then I would write that book and then I could retire. I was very fortunate in that, and I don't want to say I was very fortunate, because my life turned very hard, which led me to a point where I had to make a change. And we can explore that if you want. But I had a series of life experiences that led me to making a big fundamental change in how I viewed life and how I tackled life. Some people get that by getting cancer, right? They get a big disease, or they have a serious accident, or there's a major loss in their life. And so they take that chance to reevaluate their priorities. And then they can, maybe that springboards them into rethinking how they live their life. I had some other things happen to me that enabled me and gave me the courage to reevaluate. You and I both know that each and every one of us has the power right now to make that kind of change. My favorite line from a film is, every passing minute is another chance to turn it all around. We can decide right now to make a fundamental change. That's easier said than done, because it's scary. And you might have people counting on you, and you might have employees at a business counting on that paycheck. You may have family, you may have children that need you and expect you and want you to be putting money aside for college. And so there's real life fears and anxieties that hold a lot of people back. But you and I both know you can decide at this instant to completely overhaul how you think and how you approach life.
Yes, you can. Yeah, these are very good insights. What's the first step? What do you say? people drive, life drives us to the wall. I mean, we're just covered up with.
No, it's a great question. And like I said, it's easier said than done. I stumbled upon, I don't know if it was a book. I think it was actually an essay by a guy named Derek Sivers. And he was an entrepreneur, started a very successful company, and he did it by flying it from the seat of his pants. He didn't go into it with any very serious business, but he just built this thing and worked hard and profited out. But he wrote this article. They said, you need to have the hell yeah philosophy of life. And when he says hell yeah, when someone says, hey, I need you to do this, and that could be anything from speak at my club to write a book, to write an article, to help me with this, help me with that. And if when asked that question, whatever it is, if your answer is, oh, hell yeah, I want to do that, that would be exciting. That would be meaningful. That would be rewarding. I want to do it. Well, then do it. But if your answer is not that, then you shouldn't do it. If someone says, hey, help me with this thing, and your answer is, well, I guess I have this obligation to help this guy, or I really don't want to do it, but I don't want to upset him, or I really don't want to do it, but I think it would be rude to say no. Well, you're digging that groove, that ditch that you're in deeper.
Yes.
And it's a simple philosophy. Maybe it's too simple. Someone may be listening saying, oh, yeah, do I want to be working, living to pay my mortgage? Heck no, I don't want to be doing that. But so I get that. But the philosophy, that was when I read that and I saw that and I thought on it and reflected on it and I applied it to a lot of the things I was already doing in my life. And I thought, I'm not saying heck yeah to any of this stuff. I'm not doing anything I really want to be doing. I'm engaging in activities that I can't even now at this moment understand and recall why I ever agreed to do it in the first place. I think that can be said for most people probably listening, most people on this globe. We all of a sudden we get to this point where we're like, how did I get here? How did this happen? When did I end up being responsible for this? Because we just mindlessly follow along. And when people say, oh, do this, okay, because I guess I'm supposed to do that. And they ask me, so I guess I should say yes. So anyway, I love that exercise. And to this day, I still use it. I'm invited to do a lot of things. And if I don't say, heck yeah, you and I, let's look at you and me as an exact example of this. You and I connected, was it a week or two ago on another conversation? And then you reached out and said, hey, we ought to do this very conversation that we're having at that moment. And you and I connected and we had similar philosophies and similar aspirations and similar desires to help a common good. And so it was a heck, oh yeah, this would be an important conversation. Let's do it. So this is fun. This is rewarding. I'm not sitting there saying, oh, I got to spend an hour with Don. Ugh. No, this is the whole beauty of it. I turned down three other interviews for organizations that just didn't align with what I was trying to do. I mean, I would have wished if I had endless hours in the day, it would have been fine to do it, but I didn't. Right, so right. It's a great philosophy and it's a simple thing to do. And you'll learn how to actually analyze your responses to that question. But I suspect most people listening, if you were to apply that rule of the hell yeah process and methodology to the tasks that you're doing in your life, I bet you a significant majority of the things you're doing, you would not say, hell yeah, I'm glad to be doing this.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's very insightful. So what aspects of your life have been most positively affected by, well, following the hell yeah philosophy?
Well, how about the fact that I actually have one now?
Well, okay.
And how about the fact that it's mine? And I'm doing what I want to do. I'm engaged in the things that I want to be doing. I'm doing it on my terms. I'm not saying that you couldn't achieve those things by working for having a boss or working for a company owned by somebody else. There are millions of people who live a heck yeah kind of life, even though they work for somebody else. And that's not the point I'm making here. Right. But I was thinking through that question and I didn't have any other answers other than to say the fact is that my life is mine now. It's right. Not society's. I was looking back at my old life, Don, thinking through that very question and thinking, how many things did I do because my, quote, friends and my colleagues and my relationships, this is what they expected me to do. Right. And I had one particularly bad day. I had to drive all the way across Atlanta, which you're familiar enough with Atlanta that you don't go anywhere that doesn't take 45 minutes. Right. And there was a traffic accident. So the ride took 90 minutes and I had car trouble, which complicated the thing. And then I had business expectation that was going bad. I mean, it was just one of those days when I just wanted to walk in front of a bus and say, why is this even worth it? And I thought, Everything I just listed as causing me stress on this particular afternoon is because someone else asked and expected me to do them. It was nothing I'm doing here was because I wanted to do it. I thought, why am I in this trap? So it all always goes back to this hell yeah philosophy. So the answer to your question is no, my life is mine now. I dictate exactly what, where, and how I do things. And to have that kind of freedom is, while I may not be a billionaire, my life is priceless because I live it on my terms. I spend it with the people I care about and love, and I'm doing the kind of work that drives me, that inspires me. My life is mine now, and yes, that's priceless.
Absolutely. It's beautifully said. Beautifully said. So this internet thing, how do you use the internet? It's so amazing. How do you use it in your work, in your life?
You know, it's a great question, and I thought deeply about how to answer that question. And is there a tool, or is there an app? Is there a this? Is there a that? And I looked back on it, and it really wasn't anything. There isn't a specific thing I can recommend that changed my life. What the internet's done for me is open up the world. Now you're connected to the entire planet, and you can learn, you can see, you can listen to, you can read virtually anything in any continent, in any country, anywhere, and the world's now your oyster. And that can almost be overwhelming. But the beauty is, what happened for me is I also learned to enjoy reading again. Like most people, reading was a burden because my teacher told me to read this book. Because I was a smart-ass punk kid, I resisted, and all this great literature in school that I refused to read. Now, really, what an idiot I was. I was actually required to read these great works of literature that at the time seemed like a burden. So I started reading again. And there's a point to this story, so to answer your question. But I started reading again, and I have this deal where my goal is to read a book a week. And so let me assure you, there's plenty of people reading a lot more than that. But for me, reading a book a week is a big chore and a big improvement over how I lived most of my life. But that has changed everything for me. It's not just business books. It's philosophy books. It's entertainment books. It's all different kinds of books. It's fiction, nonfiction. There's no rules on that. To answer your question, it's the internet that has exposed me to all this great stuff that I can now read. And it's connecting to an audience and connecting to a network on social media that recommends some of this great stuff that I now read. And so to me, that's the real power and how the internet has benefited me most, is that it has opened up my eyes to all the possibilities and all the amazing work that's out there, all this amazing art that I never knew existed, that now I can get to most of it, 99% of it, I can get to it for free. And so that's how the internet served me, is it's put in my lap virtually an endless supply of amazing stuff to read, which then opens my eyes, which then educates me, which then inspires me, which then enables me to be more creative and better serve my audience and my clients, and just makes me better.
Beautiful. So briefly, where are you headed in the next few years? What's your vision going forward?
It's a great question. And I don't feel good about my answer, but I actually do, because it's still in alignment with my hell yeah philosophy. But it's to continue building what I'm building. My job now, as I see it, is to entertain and educate people through the interviews that I do, through the business series that I organize and produce for my clients. I'm hoping that I'm entertaining and educating people. And I want to continue to do that. I want to get better at it. I want to continue to connect with, I've touched not even 0.1% of the amount of interesting, amazing people out there. I want to keep building that archive of amazing conversations with amazing people. So, and I want to get better at it. And that's where I want to go. That's the next couple of years. A direct answer to that question is I want to continue building my media network, obviously, but I want to continue to expand that and to learn new things and to teach my audience new things and continue to expose me and them to just more amazing people.
Perfect. What are you proudest of in your life to this point?
Yeah, great question. No, that I do have my own life again, yes, that I am in control. And the whole point to my story was, for most of my life, I didn't think I had that control, right? I didn't think I was allowed to do something that was against what society and culture expected of me. And so the fact that I was able to, it was a hard road. I lost a marriage. I had a lot of financial duress. I lost a lot of friends along that way. And so it was not an easy path, but it was a path that I had to go through. And I've now gotten to a place where I now am in control, and I feel good about it. When I wake up in the morning, I don't have to dread going into a place where I don't want to be and work with people I don't want to work with. I get up now and I am excited. You know, we all have this, we all can understand this, but there was always that Sunday night dread, right? Oh, I have to go to school tomorrow. Ugh. Or I have to go to the office tomorrow. Blah. It always ruined Sunday for me. because I always knew on Sunday that tonight I'm going to be depressed because I have to do something tomorrow that I don't want to do. And I think another way to answer your question of what I'm most proud of is that I dig Mondays now, because as an entrepreneur that works for myself and I work out of my home, and I'm very fortunate that my wife works out of the home as well. And so for us, I feel like every day is a Saturday. I mean, it's a great, you know, I work hard, and let me assure you, like everyone else, I have bad days. So it's not this perfect rosy life. And like most people, you have problems and things, but now the problems aren't these punishments from the world. Now it's just kind of exciting, interesting challenges that, all right, well, how do we tackle this? And let's figure out how we solve this problem. And so that's what I'm most proud of, that I live a life where that's possible.
You live your own life. It's perfect. Yeah. Todd Schnick, what a great pleasure being with you today. We thank you for sharing the highlights of your life journey, and I know that listeners have learned lessons that will help them on theirs. So how do those listeners connect with you?
Well, the best way to connect with me is if you go to intrepidmailinglist.com. So if you just type in intrepidmailinglist.com, you'll come to a sign up window where you can join the mailing list for my media network, and then you'll get all the content that we produce, which is delivered Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings. And 90% of the content that we put out there, and we put out a lot of content, let me promise you, isn't for everyone. So, but you will stumble upon something interesting, some conversation that we have with an amazing individual doing amazing things, building something really cool that could be changing the world, that will have some impact on you. So that's really the best way to connect with me is just to join my mailing list, and then you'll see all the stuff they're producing. And I promise somewhere in there, you're going to stumble upon an interview or a conversation or someone's essay that will change the way you think about something. And that's a good thing.
I love it. That is a good thing. Listeners know you can go to our homepage, discovertalentpodcast.com, to the podcast section. You can find Todd Schnick's name and the highlights of this illuminating interview, along with the connecting point. So I hope you'll do that. Thank you, listeners across the world, for joining us today. We appreciate you. You know, we have an infographic, What Do Highly Successful People Actually Do to Succeed? 12 Proven Career Building Strategies to Help You Do What You Love, which are some of the great lessons that have been in our societies for many, many years that have helped millions of people. And it's free, and we hope it'll be a thought starter or thought generator for you wherever you are in your career. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. If you like the content, please do. We'd like to have you be a part of our tribe, and we want to know how we can serve you better. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them, and we cannot ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive, we thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.